This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. This week, Senator Evan Bayh, a Democrat from Indiana, announced he will not seek re-election. He did it while lambasting partisanship and didn't talk to the president or the Senate Majority Leader before making his decision. Also, members of the Obama administration are hitting the road to talk of the economy and what the president has done and will do to get things moving. And closer to home, Governor Culver's approval rating is at an all-time low, just 9 months before the election. With a tight budget and another round of flooding possible in the coming months, how will that play out in Iowa? It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson will be our guests, and we'll take your calls and emails. That's coming up on Talk of Iowa. First, this news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. Indiana Senator Evan Bayh said he will not seek re-election, but the way that he did it and what he says has a lot of people wondering what that means for national politics. Also, President Obama is sending out some of his staff members to talk up the economy, and here in Iowa, Governor Culver's approval ratings are at an all-time low. We'll talk about those issues and more on Talk of Iowa. It's Politics Day. Stephen Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, is here in our Des Moines studio. Stephen, welcome.
Good morning.
And Arnie Arneson, a New Hampshire political analyst, is on the line from New Hampshire. Arnie, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Wow, the room is kind of down today. Wow.
You noticed. Can't be perky.
All right. What has you glum?
Jonathan, this was the week we were supposed to talk about happy news, isn't it? Oh, no, that was a few weeks ago. And we haven't found anything to ever repeat that week either in Iowa or anywhere else, it looks like.
So is it Evan Bayh's announcement that he's not going to seek re-election, criticizing partisan politics, the fact that a moderate of one of the parties is bolting away, and that he didn't even think enough to talk to the president or the Senate Majority Leader before making his decision? Is that what you guys got down today?
Yeah, that's enough.
Well,
you know, as Stefan, I'm listening to the sort of litany of things that touch on Evan Bayh's decision, the thing that bothers me so much is that he's known that the situation is a mess in Washington. He knows that bipartisanship is basically dead. All these things he knew 6 weeks ago, 6 hours ago, 6 months ago, and yet the decision to make, you know, to pull out 24 hours before the deadline is basically throwing a middle finger up at the party, at the country, and at the president. And I don't understand why Senator Bayh, who to a large extent is very respected, is a very sort of moderate Democrat, who has a father who was really, you know, very courageous. He was very courageous. He lost his Senate race in his final term because he was so courageous. And his son seems to lack all that courage, including anything called political respect.
But I think it's symptomatic. I mean, I don't really personally care about Senator Bayh. You know, he doesn't represent me and so on. But it's because I think, in fact, he himself really is frustrated as much at Harry Reid and at Nancy Pelosi and at President Obama as he is at the cohesive Republican opposition that has not really wanted to yield on issues. And I think that makes his decision symptomatic of something a lot bigger than the fact that he's not respectful or something like that. I mean, I think that he may have timed it this way because he finally reached a conclusion. Remember, Obama took many, many weeks before he decided what to do in Afghanistan. And yet we all knew what he was going to do in Afghanistan. Bayh may have known that he was frustrated, that he really thought there was nothing much that could be done in the next Congress after the 2010 elections, because the Republicans no doubt are going to have even more members in the Senate especially. And so the timing was more, I think, to prevent some unqualified Democrat from getting the signatures, getting on the primary ballot, and then getting essentially the nomination for his vacant seat, because he probably trusts the Indiana Democratic Party more to go out and pick someone that can really win this election. I mean, there's a woman who almost got the necessary signatures. She says she did, but it looks like she didn't, to get on that ballot. And she's completely unqualified to run, and would have no doubt lost hugely to any Republican, you know, that would have been put on the ballot. She's never run for office. She seems not really politically very engaged even, and I think that's why he did it this way.
Well, there's one thing I wanted to start the show with off, Jonathan, and we just posted it on InsiderIowa.com. We decided to do like the quote of the day, and I'm going to make a recommendation. At the end of the year, I want everyone to go back to the quote of the day, because it will almost be a history of America, because it will tell us how bad things had to get before we were either crashing and burning or beginning to realize that we have to be Americans. And this is the quote from today. It's from former Senator Alan Simpson, Republican, Wyoming. Alan is a friend of mine, Stefan. I've known him for years. We've given talks together. He was just appointed by President Obama to be on that bipartisan blue ribbon commission to address the whole issue of deficits and taxes. But listen to what Alan Simpson said. There isn't a single sitting member of Congress, not one, that doesn't know exactly where we're headed. And to use the politics of fear and division and hate on each other, we are at a point right now where it doesn't make a damn whether you're a Democrat or a Republican if you've forgotten you're an American. Oh, my God.
Well,
amen. That should be on the top of every building. That should be on every billboard. We have forgotten that we are Americans. And that is my finger of guilt pointed at every member of Congress, because they are sacrificing America because of partisan politics. Shame on them.
Is that quote too long to get tattooed on my arm?
Oh, I swear to God. No, I want to embroider it on everyone's pillow.
Not if you started at the top and go down to your hand. It isn't.
Well, now while Evan Bayh's decision definitely could, in some people's opinions, be the latest sign of the destruction of any semblance of bipartisanship or productive work out of Congress, many conservatives are pointing out that they believe that Senator Bayh's decision was more inspired by a confidence that he would lose his seat in the general election, and that they're saying that this is the Democrats waving the white flag and they know they've been licked.
Well, that, of course, what else would they say? Because, in fact, if they say, yeah, you know, it's because, as Bayh said, even at a quote, this is my quote of the day, even at a time of enormous challenge, the people's business is not being done. If they had said they agree with him, then, of course, the finger of blame in part would have been pointed at them, because they have said no to every bipartisan effort. And Obama had to go out and find an aging sort of bipartisan former senator in retirement to put on this commission, because no current live and breathing Republican with any political aspirations wants to be on anything that's bipartisan in any way whatsoever. And, you know, that includes poor Senator McCain, who has got two challengers against him in Arizona and is going to fight for his life to retain his name on the ticket for the Senate race in Arizona, which is unbelievable. He's not conservative enough, and he has cooperated with the Democrats. As I said in my video blog in Insider Iowa, that has now become essentially a sign of disloyalty. You know, if you talk to the people in the other party, then that's a sign of disloyalty. Well, folks, you know, if you like that, if you like the edgy bipartisan, the end of bipartisanship, and it's my party and that's your party and we can't get together on anything, you're going to see gridlock from the city council to the county boards of supervisors, certainly to the legislatures, such as the Iowa legislature and the New Hampshire legislature, and certainly Congress. And then nothing is going to get done. And that doesn't produce what people need and expect from government, which is actually essentially problem-solving and decision-making. Nobody's going to have an overwhelming majority that they can override all of the mechanisms that have been put in place to block a majority from ever getting anything through, and that's pretty risky. That's dangerous.
I'm going to do something actually very dangerous now. I'm going to defend some members of Congress, so, you know, make sure you note this.
No, Arne, you stop that.
But the problem is that if the American people want bipartisanship, If even members of Congress want bipartisanship, this is a quote from today's New York Times. Republicans today see opposition as a way back to power in November. So if power is their goal, then being persnickety and not bipartisan is really the power back, okay? But more importantly, because they are courting the Tea Party movement, and they are doing this, Jonathan, conservative activists have promised to oppose any Republican that shows any signs of compromise. Okay? So here's the problem. You might win a general election if you compromise, but if you compromise, you may lose your primary. And right now, the Tea Party movement has targeted approximately 10 elections in this country, 10 Senate elections. There are 10 states that are basically in play, especially for the Tea Party movement, and they could make a significant, significant change in the result, whether they run as independents, whether they basically kill a Republican in the primary, or whether they basically undermine a Democrat. That's the problem. Even if you want to do it, the fear of losing your primary, let alone the general election, means that, you know what, you take a deep breath and you say, gag me till the end of November of 2010.
If you'd like to weigh in on this or any other topic, you can send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call us at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100 is the phone number to call. Now, when you talk about bipartisanship, and Stefan, you and Arnie, you both of you have talked about the need for more bipartisanship. Isn't it by nature that the party in power has the real obligation to make that happen? And I'm not suggesting that it's easy, and I'm not suggesting that the minority party, regardless of which one it is ever going to go along with that because, as Arnie, you said, they see opposition as the path to regaining power. But isn't it the obligation of the majority party to incorporate some of the ideas, even if the minority party ends up voting against it and saying, look, we put them in? And we listened, and here's our compromise.
Well, maybe, but if I'm in a meeting, I have a consulting firm. I'm also a member of the political science department. We have meetings. We sit around. We have issues that come up. We discuss them. We say, what are the best strategies here? What decisions are we going to make? And then we vote on it. I have never appreciated the one or two individuals who will not want closure in those meetings and who say, well, you know, I really don't agree. I know that most of you agree, but I think I have other ideas and I don't want to do that, and who delay a decision. Then we leave the meeting having not made a decision because a few people did not want essentially to acknowledge that the majority, you know, had a plan and it didn't conform to them. So instead of saying, let's do it, they say, let's wait until my ideas are in there. So that's what I worry about.
We'll have more on this topic. We'll also talk the economy, and a little bit later in the show, Governor Culver and his approval ratings. As Politics Day on Talk of Iowa continues, your phone calls at 866-780-9100. You can also send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull, Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Artisan are here taking your phone calls, 866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to the phones. Mary in Iowa City has a comment about Senator Evan Bayh. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, it's good riddance to Bayh. Because if you read David Pluff's book about how he was Obama's manager, and he said that Bayh was one of the persons up to be vice president, but Biden beat him out. And then when he had run for president, Clinton beat him out. Hillary Clinton beat him out. So this man is angry, and because when he said why he wasn't running, the first person he named, he said people from the left and on the right, too. And in this country, we have to have a real discussion about race, because the only reason that the Republicans can remain united is because Obama is black. That's one of the oldest racist tricks in the world, when the white people get together and they decide they're not going to speak to this black person. And every black person, you can go to any black person and ask them, has that ever been tried on him?
Mary, the Republicans seem to be pretty united against Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid as well. How does that play into your theory?
But that's only incidentally. I don't like Nancy Pelosi myself. And if Harry, and
you think it's, you think it's incidental that the Republicans are united in their opposition to Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi?
Because they're useless. I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat all my life. Those two people are useless because they never, and they keep talking about, we had 60. They never had 60 because they had two independents. They had all those blue dogs like this by. So the Democrats only had 45 votes in the first place. And that threat about they're going to have that filibuster, let's get it on with the filibuster. And we can show those Republicans just where we stand.
I think we heard the next Speaker of the House. I think I'm going to ask you to run.
Mary, thank you very much for your phone call. Now, I think that maybe what that Mary's call shows is that obviously people who may be stalwarts in the left are probably not happy with moderates. And we certainly know that people on the right, far right, are not happy with moderates. And Stefan, something you saw in the New York Times about the Tea Party movement here. This was something you wanted to
do. Well, it is very fascinating. This is from Idaho, and this woman who has never been very politically active but is very concerned about stuff. Here's the quote. Worried about hyperinflation, social unrest, or even martial law, she and her Tea Party members joined a coalition in Idaho called Friends for Liberty, which includes representatives from Glenn Beck's 912 Project, the John Birch Society, and Oath Keepers, a new player in a resurgent militia movement. Now, this is incredibly interesting because it isn't just sort of opposition and wanting new people in there. There is a real smell of, let's call it, insurgency that sometimes comes from the Tea Party get-togethers that goes far beyond electoral politics, far beyond challenging somebody in a primary. And I think it shows a desperation, an anger that is feeding into a movement. And the Tea Party, there was a very interesting article that I saw in, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, that the Tea Party is more or less sort of 99.9% white. It's pretty much like ivory soap. And the caller who just called, while it may not be true that pulled this on Obama because Obama is black, there is a post-racial politics in the United States is an unfulfilled promise of the election of Barack Obama. He is president. That was amazing. There was a coalition that had no problems electing a dynamic, charismatic, good speaker who happened to be African-American. But to think that race is not still an amazingly powerful undercurrent in American politics is, I think, to not be cognizant, for example, of what is still happening in the solid South.
So, if Hillary Clinton was elected president,
yep,
do we really think there would be any significant lack of opposition coming from the Republican Party?
There would be an enormous opposition to Hillary Clinton because there's also a strong undercurrent still against women in politics. demographic characteristics on you in the middle of this. But Iowa is the perfect example in which go talk to people and they will tell you it is really, really difficult for a woman to get elected to an office in Iowa, especially to any of the big offices, members of Congress, Senate, governor. So that's also there. There's a big gender gap. I just lectured on that, in fact, in my civil rights lecture in my political science class. The statistics are really clear. And so we have these things that we don't want to acknowledge, but that are there, and that besides the economy, besides Afghanistan, budget deficits and so on, are still very, very strong motivators for people when they go vote.
Arnie.
This didn't happen overnight. This is a growing, slow burn. It's the loss of the manufacturing sector. It's women entering the workforce. It's the growing gap between rich and poor. It's the 10% unemployment. It's the bailout of Wall Street and everyone seeing Wall Street with bonuses and they can't pay their damn bills. It is, if you look, it is cataclysmic, but it hasn't happened because Barack Obama is elected or maybe Hillary Clinton was elected. Even if there was a Republican in office, even if it was John McCain and Sarah Palin, people would be outraged. Because the irony is there's a piece today in the New York Times that described 1 year since the stimulus. And you know what? It did work. It worked far better than most people have a clue to, but they will never know it because the problem is it was oversold, okay? It was underexplained. There's so many things wrong with what we don't know about the stimulus. I would almost wish, Jonathan, that you read the article out loud to everyone on Iowa Public Radio and then have a public discussion about the stimulus, because it is mind-boggling when you realize how successful it is.
But here's the problem. When
you're unemployed, it ain't successful for you.
Arnie, do you listen to public radio ever? listen to public radio?
I do. Now
okay, yesterday I was waiting, for the class to empty out in my car before I could go into the classroom and give my talk to my 220 students. Right. There was a fantastic interview on public radio with some research that was done on the real unemployment rate. And maybe you heard it. It was that among young, uneducated, and minorities in the United States, the unemployment rate is actually about 35%. That the stimulus package was fantastic for non-minority, middle-class, educated, those in managerial positions. If your income was $150,000, it was fantastic. If your income is $100,000, it was good. As the income level went down, the impact of the stimulus package was zero. And it had no impact, apparently, on all of those who are not part of the new, information society, the service society, who are uneducated, didn't finish high school, didn't go to college. So the stimulus package was great because it saved a lot of teachers' jobs. It saved a lot of jobs in universities. I know that most universities got stimulus money from their governors so that they could retain tenured faculty and other positions. It was a very one-sided stimulus, Arnie. And in the unregulated industries of this country, there is none. I was in Fort Lauderdale for a huge meeting. I actually met Governor Crist and had a nice conversation with him last week. The waterfront of Fort Lauderdale is dead. They built this fantastic place that used to have restaurants, bars, Gucci stores and everything boarded up. Inland from the coastal area in Fort Lauderdale, there are entire neighborhoods where every single house is in foreclosure. Exactly. I drove over there to look at them. So there in the service sector industry like that, that stimulus package really didn't do much.
The extension of COBRA, the extension of unemployment, the extension of welfare benefits, I hate to say it, went to all those people that you were just describing, because one of the comments they made in the New York Times today was that we saw an increase in consumer spending despite the fact that wages went into the toilet. And the only reason we saw an increase in consumer spending was because of the stimulus, where state and local governments were able to cut checks for those people that you were just describing who were the most vulnerable. They
with
didn't get a job,
money.
But they could pay
with,
a bill.
With taxpayer money, Arnie, it wasn't from jobs. It was because the government sent people a check.
All right. The music's going, guys. Good discussion. We'll have more on this after the Environment Report, which is coming up next. More of your phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100, or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org.
Your tax dollars now backing up new nukes. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. President Obama says the country has to build more nuclear power plants in order to cut the greenhouse gas emissions causing climate change. The administration is announcing it will back the construction of two new nuclear reactors. If they're built, they'll be the first reactors in the country in nearly three decades. Mark Brush has been following this. So, Mark, where are they building these things?
Well, if they go up, they'll be in Georgia between Savannah and Atlanta. The Southern Company says if it gets final approval, the reactors will be finished in 6 to 7 years. The company says it'll cost around $14 billion to build them. It's been tough for these power companies to find money to build new nuclear reactors. That's because investors just see them as risky. When these big power plants are built, they often have cost overruns. These government-backed loans the president announced and other incentives might entice Wall Street to invest again. Now, nuclear power is not always a popular choice with the public. There's the memory of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And there's that little three-eyed fish that swims around on episodes of The Simpsons.
Blinky.
Yeah, Blinky. But officials say today's nuclear energy is safe. President Obama's energy secretary is Stephen Chu.
We expect that the newer generation reactors will be ideally completely passively safe, which means that you don't actually need to control the reactor. If you lose control of it, it will not melt down.
Some environmentalists just disagree. They say it's not worth the costs, and there's still the problem with what to do with all that nuclear waste. Right now, there's no permanent place to put it, and it's radioactive for thousands of years.
It's a nuclear renaissance, Mark. I'm all aglow.
You look radiant.
This is the Environment Report. If you want to reduce your carbon footprint by using less energy, it can cost you something. More efficient cars, tightening up your home, Energy Star appliances, they all cost more. That's why some states are testing whether homeowners would be willing to borrow money to upgrade their homes and, in turn, save a few bucks. Peter Payette has more on that.
When you hear green building, you might think of a fancy new house with solar panels. But most homes are not new, so reducing the amount of energy communities use means doing something about old houses. Max Strickland owns a business in Michigan that certifies green homes and buildings, and he says more than half the houses in the U.S. were built before 1970.
We had very little energy code requirements previous to that, so those homes are tremendously inefficient. So we have huge opportunities to make a difference by trying to upgrade those existing homes.
But upgrades cost money that many homeowners don't always have. And a lot of people saw whatever equity they had in their house disappear during the past couple of years. Now the state of Michigan is trying to help people borrow money to make their homes more energy efficient. The program is called Michigan Saves, and the state launched a pilot project in a rural area this month. Mark McKellar is with Members Credit Union, the lender in the pilot. He says these are unusual loans, and that's why a pilot will be helpful.
They're trying to determine through this study, how do you get a consumer to actually do this, and what are the benefits?
The main benefit is borrowers should save money on their utility bills, especially heating costs. Sometimes loans like these are promoted as immediately paying for themselves. That is, it's suggested the money you save will fully cover your new payment. But Mark McKellar says that's not necessarily the case. He says after a few years, people will be able to break even on the costs. Government incentives and other rebates will help that happen. But McKellar says people shouldn't expect to take out a loan, retrofit their house, and not have to pay more each month.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are here for Politics Days. Politics Day, your phone calls and emails as well. Let's start with Scott in Mason City. Scott is on the line. Welcome to the program, Scott. Do we have Scott? Scott from Mason City. I guess we don't have Scott. Dawn in Iowa City is on the line. Dawn, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to comment on an earlier segment, which is that I think that President Obama has pretty much bent over backwards trying to incorporate the ideas of the minority. I just don't think that they have been very forthcoming with ideas.
Can you give us a couple of examples of what ideas from the Republicans that he's been able to incorporate?
Well, if you look at the health care overhaul bill, for example, he's gone from, you know, health care reform to health insurance reform. And that's a pretty big step from where many of the progressives who elected the president started. He has repeatedly asked them for ideas. What can you accept? What can you live with? And they didn't have any. They didn't give him any.
Don, I think
To that end, he has alienated a lot of people in his own party.
Well, he was going to close Guantanamo, and then he decided not to do that. He really wanted to wrap up and wind up the military operations in Afghanistan and do something else, and got basically, I think, talked into essentially what would have been a Bush-Cheney policy of ramping it to by another 30,000, regardless of whether you think that's right or not. That was not what he got elected on. And so those are also examples of where, especially Democrats, are really disappointed with him, because that's not why they voted for him. And that's a problem. When you get elected by a group of people, you make them promises, and then you don't keep them because you are going to be bipartisan and give others, a piece of the action. You then lose and alienate those who voted for you. And they're going to stay away in this election.
Well, let me just give an example.
I just wanted to add one thing. I mean, you know, the Democrats won in this election, and this goes back to what Stefan said, sitting around the table, you know, talking to other department heads or people in your department. The Democrats won this election. You know, Democrats are the majority, and so their policies should be affected. When George Bush was president, you know, the Republican party platform was affected.
Don,
why would it's Democrats
Don,
do
Don.
At the Congress?
Don,
okay.
It's unfortunate that Scott from Mason City wasn't on the line, because the point that he wanted to make was that he believes a lot of the problem is that people don't trust President Obama, and with some of the things that Stefan said, because you talked about the Democrats are in the majority, but a lot of those planks that they ran on, the president has not implemented. So do you believe there's distrust of the president among Democrats because the things that President Obama ran on have not come to fruition yet?
Yes, I believe that there's deep disappointment on the left because those things haven't come to fruition. But I believe they haven't come to fruition because the president has been trying to be bipartisan. And yet now Democratic senator leaves the Senate and basically blames Obama and the Democrats for not being bipartisan, when in fact a lot of people on the left are deeply disappointed because he's been too bipartisan. So
and also,
no matter what he does,
remember that the Democrats themselves are very divided, as the previous caller said. When you look at where they got elected, there's something like 35 seats where Democratic House members won in districts where John McCain and Sarah Palin actually won the electoral vote. So they got elected in pretty conservative districts. And so they are not going to jump on board national health care and other things because, again, they want to get reelected. And so this is another huge, huge problem for the Democrats and for Obama.
Stefan, that doesn't make sense. If they won in districts that McCain and Palin won, they won because of what Barack Obama was saying. And if what Barack Obama was saying was, I'm going to produce health care reform and I'm going to do all those things, then in some ways they're almost obligated to go to the mat on those things, because that's why they won in a Republican district. Not because they were mouthing the McCain-Palin lines, but because they were basically mirroring what Barack Obama said. But more important, let me give you an example. As of just today, there were a number of Republican senators, including my senator, Senator Judd Gregg, who wanted that panel on budget deficits and deficit reduction, and yet he offered it up, he was talking about it, and then when it came for a vote in the Senate, he voted against it, because the collective wisdom of the Republicans is to vote against everything, even though 24 hours before, a week before, a month before, he was urging the Senate to pass this, because this was the answer. But guess what? They can't come up with an answer until November of 2010, and they retake either the House or the Senate, because answers are not possible. And
okay,
that's why it's so ironic. There's a perfect example.
I'm dying to say something, but Jonathan, I think, wants to move on. But what I was going to say,
quick?
Yes, I can. Arnie, a lot of those Democrats that ran in districts that were Palin and McCain won did not run on Obama's platform at all. I mean, you look at the South, you look at Blue Dogs, they didn't. They're very conservative. They're pro-life. They are in favor of handgun ownership and transportation across state borders.
Barack Obama didn't run on life. Wait. Stefan, stop. Barack Obama did not run on abortion. Barack Obama did not run on guns. Barack Obama ran on a lot of other things, Afghanistan, on being Dot Bush, on talking about health care reform. But those hot-button emotional issues, Barack Obama is not talking about those.
Arnie, the fact that somebody voted for Obama doesn't mean that they can't vote for a conservative Democrat on that ticket. I mean, people split their vote all the time. They vote for Obama, then they vote for a Republican for the House. That still happens a lot when we look at voting behavior. So the fact that they voted for Obama doesn't necessarily mean that they were bought into all of his policies. And since he didn't talk about abortion and guns and so on, they might have thought, well, you know, he seems like he probably is okay on those, but I'm going to vote for the congressman or woman who is a conservative Democrat and is on my side because I know them better. So, you know, that it's a mixed bag that came out of the 2008 election, a very, very mixed bag.
Okay, let's just wrap up Evan Bayh here with an out question.
He's running for president in 2012.
You think so?
Yeah, against Obama.
I know this.
That's right.
I feel like the reason he made this decision was he sat down with his consultants because he was basically covering his base both ways.
Okay,
he is
now,
running for president in 2012. You can make
with Hillary Clinton as his running mate. There you go.
Stefan in Ames, a different Stefan in Ames, emailed us to ask, would it be a surprise to either of you if Bayh releases some kind of tell-all book about the lack of bipartisan politics? And does he get any credit for at least filling out his term, unlike Sarah Palin?
I heard also that he may have some Edwardian skeletons in his closet. He's very good looking. He travels around a lot, and he knows Tiger Woods. So that's the other rumor. I heard that he felt that he needed to go and move on to something else. You know, if you are in the private sector, that's a little more acceptable. But of course, I don't know if that's true or not, but let's smear him anyway. I'm just passing on what I heard, that there was suspicion of that. Yes, he's going to write a book. It is going to be a book that lays out his own personal philosophy, that says that Democrats have veered too far to the left. Obama didn't have leadership skills, and he is going to pull the Democratic Party down into the bottom of the pit with him if he runs for re-election in 2012. Obama has said that he's fine being a one-term president, and Bayh is going to say, that's fine with me as well, but I think I can do a better job, and I'll pull together more moderate Democrats and some Republicans around a new Democratic Party vision that does not include Nancy Pelosi's philosophy or Harry Reid, who will probably not even be reelected anyway.
Let's go to Dan.
As a sort of a bow on this discussion, James Fallows, who writes for The Atlantic Monthly, wrote a piece about Evan Bayh as he made the decision to, you know, at this very last-minute decision to not run. And he basically says, okay, you've been in politics for 25 years. Here is your chance, since you still have to stick around for a little bit longer. What are you going to do, and what kind of leadership are you going to exhibit in the U.S. Senate, since you have, since you're so disgusted, but now you are so damn liberated because you're not asking for a vote? Will you use this as an opportunity to lead in the Senate, or are you going to punt?
All right, let's go to Dan in Fort Dodge. Dan, you're on the program. You've got a comment on President Obama.
Yes, Obama has bitten off more than he can chew. Reminds me of Will Rogers' statement, I don't belong to any organized political party, I'm a Democrat. Here's a couple of things to gnaw on. There is no popular opposition to a bill that would outlaw the insurance company exemption from the antitrust law. Yes.
Except that money is very popular, and that lobby gives a lot of money to politicians on both sides.
That will smoke out the people who are causing the problem. There is also no popular opposition to a law prohibiting health insurance companies from discriminating against people on the basis of pre-existing conditions. There is no popular opposition. The Canadian general health care law is 8 pages. We do not need 2,000 pages of BS. We need step-by-step reform, and either of these two proposals will smoke out the people that are owned by the special interests and who don't care crap about what the public gets.
Dan, thank you very much for your
there
call.
You
now,
go.
Now, Dan from Fort Dodge thinks the president should focus on two very specific pieces, try to get those through.
Yep.
This week, the president, instead of working on health care, is dispatching a lot of people to run around the country and talk about the economy. Is this shift, Arnie, Stefan, is this shift of focus appropriate? And do you think it'll do any good?
Oh, God.
I'm going to stay quiet now.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, here's the problem. We spent a year running up and down the flagpole about health care. He better get something. That's all I have to tell you right now. If he walks away after a year of hemorrhaging on this issue and have nothing to show for it, he shouldn't get reelected. Okay, I'm just telling you right now. But the problem is, the reason why he's running around about jobs is that it turns out because he did not frame the health care discussion in the term of jobs, in the ability to say that manufacturers, instead of having to put money into the line item called insurance coverage, they could put the line item into something called salaries, you know, it's turned out that jobs has eclipsed everything. So he has an unfinished year called health care. He's got the huge job problem, which he oversold with the small stimulus that everyone told him that said the stimulus was not going to be big enough to do the right kind of effect that will be noticeable to the American people. So now he's talking jobs, which is why your caller got so apoplectic. Because in the end, Americans don't care, Republican, Democrat, Tea Party, they want to see change and they want to see something that resembles success.
But Arnie,
they have seen nothing.
You know, a big stimulus package is occurring in the form of massive spending for the military, which is mostly domestic spending. I mean, every dollar that you spend on the military, we don't buy stuff from Walmart made in China for the military. It's almost all American manufacturing, remanufacturing, retooling the military, resupplying them, and so on. So that was part of the stimulus package as well, if you want to call it that. And the spending that Obama has done, as you know, was so enormous for all kinds of different things, bailouts, the military, the jobs creation, you know, the shovel-ready projects and all that, that the Europeans and others are freaked out about the American borrowing deficit and about the national debt. And so, you know, we are on the edge of a very difficult economic situation in which even the Europeans, whom we all love, don't we, Arnie? They drive little tiny cars. They, you know, they're very politically correct in every respect, are now freaked out because the Greeks are crashing, the Poles are crashing, the Italians, the Portuguese, and the Spanish, and the Irish. Their economies are going tanking, and the Germans are now left and told, you're the rich guy here, you're the banker of Europe, now you bail out the euro. And the Germans are saying no. The Germans are saying, we have just told our workers that they're going to get big salary cuts and layoffs and reduced work hours. We are not bailing out the Greeks.
What's the German model? What's the German model? The German model is eat your spinach, make the tough decisions, slash budgets, raise taxes, act like an adult. You don't get something for nothing. That's the German model. Then, damn it all, where's our model? Our model is mañana, not yet, tax cuts,
next year,
deficit spending.
Arnie, our
model.
Our model is you saying that Obama had a little tiny stimulus package and he should have spent a huge additional amount of taxpayer money to stimulate the economy when he has, in fact, spent huge amounts, and we've talked about that. You know, the U.S. government is a gigantic money-generating machine that's pouring money into the American economy, and it is having a small amount of effect, but the pump is still going.
Okay.
There's no water coming out of the American economic pump. You know what I'm talking about, priming the pump. But
out question here, and then I want to try to touch on Governor Culver before the end of the show. The out question, we've gotten two emails, one from Sonia in Iowa City that says, is there any way to have a third party built from the ground up that would be related to centrist positions? And then we had an email from Tim who said, third party is what's necessary, but it's completely unable to launch it in this political system, and that he thinks the only thing that's going to change for a new America is a revolution of the people.
The answer is no, and the Tea Party appears to be trying to morph itself into a political party of sorts, because I think they are actually backing candidates, and very soon they may actually be having Tea Party members running for office and challenging, especially Republicans. So there is something that looks like it might be a third party. And yes, I think we are at a very dangerous point in history. These are the kinds of conditions in a country that lead to people becoming hugely frustrated. If you're unemployed, you don't see any chances of ever being unemployed. The unemployment is concentrated in the areas where it was in the 60s. And then later, when you had all huge urban riots in the United States because people were so desperate, you know, the Watts riots and the riots in New Jersey and Chicago and other places. I think there's a real danger of this becoming a basically violent kind of development unless we can start turning this around. I really do. I'm very concerned about it.
Arnie, do we need to light the torches and sharpen the pitchforks?
Well, but here's the interesting thing. Didn't we just talk about the fact that the unemployment rate for young people and maybe people of color and Hispanics, 25%, 35%, the 10% doesn't really reflect the huge yawning gap.
Right.
And yet the Tea Party protesters are 99.9% white. They're probably 99.9% over the age of 50. You know, and I'm sort of curious, when do the people who are really hurt by this economy going to get together and protest? Isn't it fascinating, Jonathan, that the people who are the most hurting puppies, who have the longest to go, they're not going to die in 10 years. They've got a lifetime to try to figure this out. But if they don't recover in their 20s, they're never going to recover. Where are their voices? Where is their collective action? What do they ultimately want? And
well,
I that's the part that I am so amazed about.
They still
I haven't seen organization there.
Sure, but they still have a social support system. We have an enormous welfare system. And, you know, I mean, talk about what you were talking about, unemployment insurance, giving, you know, all kinds of welfare money, trying to bail out Social Security, you know, providing Medicaid, food stamps, which, as you saw, I mean, the story on food stamps is incredible. The U.S. government is out there pushing food stamps and saying, get everybody who is poor, unemployed, and who needs them to take food stamps, because we have all the surplus food, and we want people to actually have stuff in their stomach, because then they don't riot as quickly if they have some sort of at least basic life support system. And that's what our welfare system is. It puts people on that. And remember, Bill Clinton tried to say it's the end of big government as we know it, and also the welfare system has to be reformed. Well, we're back again to
Stephen
that.
Stephen is channeling Roswell Garst.
That's right.
I am. Hungry people are the ones who riot.
But there are
no, the hungry people riot because they get angry and they don't feel that they have any stake in society. As long as you can go down to all of the social services agencies and get support, which you still can at this point, you're going to have housing and food and other things, and you're not going to be quite as alienated. There is a thing called anomie and alienation, and we can talk about, you know, what the sources are.
We got 5 minutes left. We're not going to be able to talk about much. Arnie, you had a point to make.
Well, no, and someone just emailed me as they were listening to our conversation, and they said that's because young people don't have anything to lose because they don't have anything yet. And the problem with people in their late 40s and their early 50s is that they have to retrain, they have a house to lose, they have a 401k, that's a 101k. So when you have something, but you don't have it today, or you see it eroding, that's what gets you so
That's
angry.
A great point. And
young
people,
that's an incredibly important point.
That's a very important point. And I appreciate somebody sending you that email. The other thing is that young people still do believe in the American dream. They really do think that, you know, there are jobs coming down the road. We're going to go back to what it was before. You know, they still have schools and education, community colleges and colleges that where you can get a scholarship and hope for the future. And so they have that, I think, and that basically makes them less volatile and flammable. So anyway, yes, and I know that Jonathan wants to talk about Governor Culver's declining poll numbers, which we should do.
There's a new study out that says one-third of Iowans support the Tea Party protest.
Yeah, I saw that.
One-third. Now, that's actually good news for Chet. Can I tell you why it's good news? Because that means that whoever the Republican candidate is, if it happens to be someone who is too extreme as a conservative because they have their way within the Republican Party, that means that, you know, Governor Culver might win again. Or it might mean that if they don't have their way within the Republican primary, that their candidate might decide to run as an independent, and that's good news again for the sitting governor.
Right.
So it's very interesting.
That is an interesting point.
Let's put some names on this then. Arnie's assertion would be that the support for the principles behind the Tea Party, good news for Bob Vanderplaats and for Chet Culver.
Bad news for Terry Branstad, because Branstad still has this sort of more moderate profile. Although I'll tell you one thing. I, by accident, hit a website that is sponsored by and paid for by the Democrats. The entire website, huge website, is dedicated to basically trashing Terry Branstad. They don't have one trashing Vanderplaats or Rod Roberts.
Do you think that's on purpose?
I think that the Democrats are much, much more concerned about Terry Branstad getting the nomination. In fact, I know they are, and the poll numbers show. That,
are they more concerned about Branstad getting the nomination, or would they really like Bob Vanderplaats to get the nomination?
Well, I think it's a double thing. One, they want – this is directed at the Republicans as well, saying, you know, Branstad, I mean, he raised taxes. He was a terrible governor. He was, you know, really liberal and all that.
So that was years ago.
We're going to have to save a lot of this for next week or another time. Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University, Arnie Arneson of New Hampshire, thank you very much for being on the show. That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and John Pemble. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.